Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, March 9th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckaberry. Thanks for listening. There's a light, a certain kind of light. She was misunderstood in life as she was revered and hypnotic on the musical stage. Later this hour, a group of artists come together to save the home of the legendary singer Nina Simone to make it a historic place pilgrimage. Everybody say, do each and every little thing. But first, President Trump's threats and rhetoric about immigrants.
But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
We are going to build a great border wall.
Build that wall.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. They are not our friend. Believe me.
Build that wall.
The familiar language referenced during and since the campaign has finally started to produce enough fear among the undocumented to get them to consider leaving, hiding, or beginning the long, confusing process of actually trying to become a U.S. citizen. The aggressiveness of the recent Trump executive order for a travel ban has run out the clock for some communities. People and the advocates they rely on to explain the U.S. system are suddenly scrambling amidst diminished options. Since the president took office, hundreds of individuals in 11 states have been picked up in deportation raids and in on-the-spot incidents when a person's status is disclosed to the authorities. Tanya Unzueta is the legal and policy director for the Chicago-based national advocacy group Mi Gente. She's a young, seasoned advocate, often the only face standing between an undocumented person and deportation and detention.
President Obama released 6,000 people as part of his criminal justice reform and was talking about how this is a country of second chances. And literally 2,000 of those 6,000 people were actually deported and not introduced back into their communities. What we're seeing under President Trump is a much more aggressive effort. And part of the hard thing is that it's actually hasn't been a lot of new things. It's been mostly expansion of the things that already existed.
So a pretty well-oiled machine was created by the Obama administration, and now you have a much more aggressive driver.
That's right. And it's pretty scary because I do a lot of what we call deportation defense cases. And that means using community organizing and legal strategy to try to get immigration enforcement and other people with power to realize that when someone is being deported, there's actually a little bit more to that person and that there is a lot of reasons why they shouldn't get deported. Under President Obama, that was possible. Under President Trump, that feels actually really impossible. And so where in the past there was a small chance that a father with five children who had one DUI might get out of detention, today we're telling those same people, I don't know what if I can do anything for you.
Tell me a story of something that represents just how different it is right now.
Sure. In Arizona, in Phoenix in particular, there's a long history of people fighting against the deportations that were happening because of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And what Sheriff Arpaio would do is he would raid workplaces and not only take people into detention, but actually charge them with working with false documents, for example. But they were able to prove that his targeting was racially biased, that there were serious constitutional problems to the extent that the Department of Justice actually went in and investigated Arpaio. There was one woman, Guadalupe, who had been a victim of these raids, who had a felony, but who had gotten some discretion under the Obama administration to be able to stay with her children. She would check in at ICE every so often. A couple of weeks ago, she was called into the ICE office and then just didn't come out. She was taken into custody, and within that same day, she was deported. But that's actually been something happening across the board with a lot of the organizations that we work with, that our members whose cases we thought we had won are now being called into the ICE offices with a real risk that they won't come out.
So the act against one individual in a community can have a ripple effect throughout the entire neighborhood.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, and we're seeing that just across the undocumented population, there's people who are not buying houses when they were planning to buy houses and invest in sort of their long-term future. There's people who are leaving the country. There's people who are train their children to make sure that they don't open the door when someone knocks, and that even if it's a police officer, because we've also seen a lot of immigration agents pretend to be police officers. And so the level of fear and seemingly that our only option is actually to hide is something that's pretty prevalent in a lot of communities. We've been trying to give people a little bit of hope and really do believe that organizing and coming together is one of the key ways of protecting each other. But it feels really tenuous right now in terms of the amount of power that we have to protect ourselves.
What happens to the DACA recipients, as far as you can tell?
I don't know. I'm a DACA recipient myself. My sister is too. You know, so far, there's been this attitude that as long as we don't have a criminal history, we'll be fine. But there's also been this redefinition of what a criminal history means and what it means to have contact with the criminal justice system. So under the new executive orders, for example, really the range of people who are considered criminals is huge, from someone who has a criminal conviction to actually someone who's admitted to doing something that's illegal. And so I have misdemeanors, mostly having to do with civil disobediences to try to pass the DREAM Act, to talk about deportations. And under the executive orders, I'm a priority. And so it's been hard to figure out what's going to be heavier, whether it's the DACA or whether it's that I'm considered a criminal.
A lot of people who voted for Trump, there are big numbers that suggest people support this travel ban and this deportation order. Would say, well, if the net effect is that people are scared enough that they even go voluntarily or stay out, then we've done our job. That's a good thing.
And it's actually been a strategy from people on the right for a long time. Some of the state laws are designed around what's called attrition, which is basically making an environment so uncomfortable that people will leave on their own. I don't understand how it's possible to wanna inflict such pain on your neighbors and your community members that they don't see any other option but leaving.
Have you considered going back to Mexico?
No, but my family has talked about emergency plans in case particularly worried about my parents, actually, in case they get deported.
And they're not in a category that would suggest that ICE is after them at this point.
It's kind of complicated. Both of my parents have actually been very active in the immigrant rights movement. They've both been arrested for participating in peaceful civil disobedience.
Yeah, yeah.
And technically...
Have you?
Yeah, and so technically we are priority for deportation.
Mm-hmm. You're trained as an advisor, as someone who says, well, here are your options.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been turned into... You're basically just issuing warnings right now.
Warnings and trying to think about the long-term strategy. I mean, I think there's some amongst organizers and people who do this sort of work with people who are in deportation proceedings, there's this feeling that we just need to think long-term, because if we focus on losing every small fight that we have, basically losing individual people, we're not going to be able to figure this out. I think we've already been losing people. And, you know, I actually recently just came from a meeting of organizers like me where we were just looking at each other like, how are you telling people that you can't fight for them in the same ways than in the past?
You can't call 911 right now.
I think it depends. I don't want to cause this panic either. I think that there's a lot of cities like New York, like Chicago, who are making an effort to make sure that some of those emergency services, that policing, that access to resources are separated from immigration enforcement. I don't think that's completely possible, right? When someone gets arrested, for example, their fingerprints get shared. And even if local police don't automatically turn someone into ICE, ICE may still show up at their homes. The few places where we've tried to put our energy into in terms of strategies that might work is figuring out how cities like New York and like Chicago that want to be sanctuaries for people can actually reduce the interaction of individuals with police.
Does sanctuary work?
Sanctuary the way that it is now provides some layers of protection for people. But even in places that call themselves sanctuary cities, immigration enforcement is free to do immigration raids in people's homes, in the streets, and in neighborhoods. One of the efforts that we're trying to do is find actual ways that the cities can intervene in immigration enforcement and in figuring out how to not get those people, you know, who aren't dangerous to our communities, who deserve a second chance, out of the lists of potential deportees.
You have a plan, don't you, if something all of a sudden happens anywhere on a street?
Yeah, we have plans. There's people who are organizing local networks of response, rapid response, they've been calling it. There's templates that we've put out there for people to document civil rights abuses and potential violations of policy. But none of that, as of yet, has meant that we can stop a raid or stop a deportation. It's been more of witnessing, which has been really frustrating.
And so you have to have your own plan B.
You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about other people's plans. I don't think I've actually created a plan for myself yet.
There are plenty of people who listen to this radio station who are sympathetic to what you're going through. But there's, you know, a huge number of people in America who say, she's nervous, great, it's working. What do you say to them?
I guess I would just ask them to look a little bit past that and into humanity and I think question like why they have those attitudes to begin with. I mean, I really believe that there's some stereotyping happening and there's a lot of misunderstanding about the way that immigrants affect communities. And I think that one day when we look back at the way that the Trump administration treated not only immigrants, but a lot of our communities, we'll see kind of like what history judges of this moment.
Tanya, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tanya Unzueta is legal and policy director for Mi Gente. Another target of the new Trump administration that may be alarming but has become a mainstream, if aggressive, policy is rolling back rules and regulations that constitute much of the federal government's reach into our daily lives. 90 regulations ranging from consumer finance to water pollution have been rolled back so far. And Trump's approach forces bureaucrats and lawmakers to buy any new regulations they want with cancellation of two old ones. Sally Katzen worked in the Clinton administration and Obama transition team on crafting regulations. She says that it's common practice for new administrations to talk about scaling back regulations and launch government simplification programs. But so far, Katzen says, Trump's team has been particularly effective at it.
There are lots of different types of tools to be used to remove regulations, and he has taken advantage of all of them. He's stopped rules that were being developed at the end of the last presidential term. That's fairly typical. He's also suspended the effective date when regs become the law. During the Obama years, it was an instruction to the agencies to consider whether you want to delay the effective date. More importantly, the rules that are in effect. Congress has participated in this through the Congressional Review Act. The House and the Senate have together passed 3 motions of disapproval, which Trump has signed. He's also sent out a series of memos on individual regulations saying rethink, redo initiatives that were either completed or in process.
Let's talk about the 2-for-1 gig here that sounds so attractive in campaign rhetoric. Where do you get your old regs?
Well, the idea was that each department or agency would stand on its own, but there is a process for trading. I think it's a variation of a cap and trade system. But you could borrow from another department or agency with the permission of the director of the Office of Management and Budget. How freely that will be given remains to be seen. And it's important to emphasize an important qualification of the 2-for-1 order, and that is the two have to have existing or future costs equal to the cost of the new regulation that is being proposed. And that turns out to be fairly difficult because when a new regulation is issued, the bulk of the costs are in the implementation. And this presents a real dilemma if you're looking for rules that you can get rid of for a new rule.
I guess I just don't understand how you can do anything like this without looking at the significance and urgency of the regulations. It just seems on the surface to be not viable.
Well, you're touching on a critical part of the regulatory development, because for the last 40 years, we have approached regulations looking at a cost-benefit analysis. And I want to emphasize benefit, because what we have heard since January 20th are costs. Costs, costs. If you look at the 2-for-1 executive order, he mentions costs, I think, more than 15 times. He does not mention benefits. And this is a critical component of any kind of analysis. Before an agency can issue a reg, it has to engage in extensive analysis, which is reviewed by experts inside and outside the government to ensure that based on the best available information, these proposals would withstand a rigorous cost-benefit analysis.
All right, so what are the regulations, though, that conservatives who want these regulations eliminated because they're hurting the economy, what are the regulations there that are, number one, easy to get rid of, possibly that do just amount to a kind of government harassment that you could get rid of?
Well, if you look at the ones that were the subject of the Congressional Review Act, they cover the waterfront. I mean, there was a regulation from EPA that had to do with when you do surface mining, what happens to the debris? Does it go into the streams and thereby pollute the waters? That rule was eliminated. Another rule that was eliminated were payments to foreign governments by oil and gas companies overseas. That's an entirely different dimension. And there was a third rule that recently was eliminated that would have enabled the Social Security Administration to advise the National Crime Background Check System when someone is getting payments for mental illnesses. And this is designed to keep these people from purchasing firearms. These are three very different kinds of regulations, because not all regs are the same. They are very different. These three show that there are three different groups of either industries or interest groups that do not agree with what was done during the Obama administration.
All right, but could we just get an example of one that everyone would agree is just pointless? Either it's obsolete or...
There are things that we can get rid of. And every president since President Reagan has had a look back, a retrospective search for bad regs. They haven't turned up a lot, in part because, as I said earlier, to issue a reg, you have to go through a cost-benefit analysis. But I don't think that it's possible to come up with a regulation that the entire country agrees is stupid.
Then that suggests that as parties change and as different occupants of the White House take over, there must be a set of regulations that are constantly sort of batted around, kind of like a tennis match.
Well, there's actually a great example of that. It's not in a regulation, but it's in executive orders. It's called the so-called Mexico City policy, is because it was announced by Reagan in Mexico City. And it says that organizations cannot spend money on any information about birth control. And so it was imposed during Reagan. It was rolled back during Clinton. It was reimposed by George W. Bush. It was rolled back by Obama. And I think very soon we'll see that it will be reimposed by President Trump.
Sally Katzen is a law professor at the NYU School of Law, who worked on crafting regulations in the Clinton administration and on the Obama transition team. Sally, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. When a city votes down a real estate developer's plans, generally the issues are technical questions involving traffic and visibility, zoning issues and the like. Pleas like this one from college student and Bayonne resident Summer Al-Gabahi are unusual.
We're not going anywhere. This is our home. We are you. We are your business owners. We are your janitors. We are your teachers. Hopefully, I will be one of your social workers, and I cannot wait to work with this community.
But this Muslim resident, along with many others, failed to convince the city of Bayonne, New Jersey, to allow the building of a mosque and community center to accommodate worshipers who have been meeting in a local church. Zoning regulations were the reason given by authorities in a vote this week, but WNYC reporter Matt Katz says the way this local controversy developed, there's a very strong feeling on both sides that a religion, Islam, was on trial.
The local Muslims in the town, they bought this old warehouse for $1 million. They raised the money. It was on a dead-end street, and then they wanted to knock it down and build a mosque, so they had to file the paperwork with the town. And that's really when the controversy started. You saw flyers in town referencing 9/11, and hundreds of people started coming out to zoning board meetings. The process went on for about a year and a half until it culminated with this very, very tumultuous meeting. Here is a resident and opponent, Lydia Elraheb. She started reading from what she called English translations of the Quran, and she ended up calling Islam a so-called religion.
I'm not making this up. I'm reading it right out of the Quran. Okay. And do not kill your children for fear of poverty. We provide for them and for you. Killing them is a grave sin. And yet how many children have died under this so-called religion? Religion doesn't do that. No other religion.
Wow.
Yeah. There was another resident and opponent, John White. He called for an ideological test. He said he wanted to ask the Muslims in the community what they really, really believed. And then he said he's not racist for two reasons. One, Islam is not a race, so he can't be racist. And also, he noted something about his doctors, and that raised some eyebrows in the room.
I'm very happy that several of my doctors, who are excellent doctors, they're also Muslim. I have nothing to say negative about them. I am not a bigot.
I mean, it's not the case that it's much of a debate, usually, when a religious institution decides to build in any community in New Jersey, yes?
That's true. They're fairly uncontroversial decisions. With mosques, though, people don't really seem to know what to expect. With the church, you know it's going to be busy on Sunday morning. With a mosque, people hear that Muslims pray five times a day. They wonder whether there's going to be traffic there five times a day. There's so much unknown about the religion itself among a community like this, which has traditionally been Christian, that leads to a lot more questions and concerns about the impact on the local neighborhood.
Where does it go from here?
You know, the Muslims in town could look to the Justice Department. There's a history of the Department of Justice suing local towns that reject mosques. There have been several cases in the last few years in which local boards have rejected mosques in towns. The Department of Justice comes in, sues, and the mosques are then approved. But, you know, there's a question whether this Justice Department under Attorney General Jeff Sessions would really be amenable to continuing that like they had under President Obama. The other option would be to do what so many other developers have done with so many other kinds of buildings in the past, and that's go back to the drawing board, adjust the plans, and, you know, maybe make the mosque a little bit smaller so it requires fewer parking spots, and then go back before the board and hope things aren't as controversial the next time around.
WNYC reporter Matt Katz focusing on an issue controversial in Bayonne, New Jersey. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
A promise kept from a presidential campaign is rare enough, but to have it become a reality so quickly may have amazed Trump supporters who were really counting on a repeal of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Do those people actually have some benefits coming now? Losers under this plan we talked about yesterday include seniors counting on Medicaid expansion that may not happen now, but who specifically would this bill help? Here to tell us is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We talked to people who claimed they were on some benefit line where they expected to be able to get some, you know, affordable version of Obamacare. And when they got through the whole process of applying, they weren't able to. They found the whole thing infuriating. And it seems that that group became a constituency of Trump's and the Republicans' advocacy to, you know, bring down Obamacare as a campaign promise. Do you think they've targeted these individuals effectively?
It's not clear. There were sort of two groups that got disadvantaged by the Affordable Care Act. One was the people who were already in the individual market. These were mostly healthy people, because if you were sick, you couldn't buy insurance in the individual market. And these were people also who earned just slightly too much to get any of the tax credits or subsidies. So when premiums went up to help cover the sick people, they had to pay the full freight. Those people were definitely disadvantaged. There was another group, and as you mentioned, the process by which you get adjudicated for how big a tax credit you'll get is opaque and complex, and it didn't work well for everybody. And so there were some people who probably should have been getting help who weren't, or should have been getting more help and weren't getting as much as they actually should have under the law, and they were disadvantaged. But, it's perhaps the first group, the healthy people who are paying the full freight, could conceivably get some help under the Republican plan, because there might be fewer benefits offered, so they might be able to have access to cheaper insurance. But the second group, it might be easier for them to get these new tax credits, but these new tax credits in all likelihood won't go as far as the more complicated ones under the Affordable Care Act.
So simply getting a straight-ahead discount on what they're already or expecting or prefer to pay for in terms of benefits, that's not clear from this bill. The people who don't like the price and want it to just come down, everything else stay the same, it's not clear that's going to happen.
No, it's not clear that's going to happen. And partly it's a function of benefits, that people were paying more. They were paying more for better benefits. So if they got sick, they would pay less. So if they get fewer benefits, then they might have a lower cost if they don't get sick. But if they do get sick, then they'll have to pay for it. The other thing is that the Republicans can't really do a lot of the things they want to do because of the budget process that they're using to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. They can't make a lot of changes to the law that they would have liked to have made.
When do you think, as the process begins to move forward, that consumers are going to realize either that they've been hoodwinked a little bit, or that their understanding is not quite correct, or that they've actually not benefited at all from this change?
Well, the way the bill is written now, it phases in very slowly. The real question is whether, if it's to pass in the next few weeks, as Republicans want, whether the insurance industry would have enough confidence to continue to offer coverage starting in 2018. So there could be a very rapid impact, perhaps unintended, that there is no insurance to buy. But this would take a while. They wouldn't really change the tax credits or change the Medicaid provisions for another 2 years under this bill.
Wealthy people, are they targeted here at all?
Wealthy people are targeted for a big tax cut here. All of the taxes pretty much that the Affordable Care Act raised in order to pay for the expanded coverage would be repealed. So wealthy people would have way fewer taxes. In addition, there are a lot of programs that help people who have enough money to put away for health care, put that away tax advantaged, and this would re-expand those, things like health savings accounts and flexible spending accounts. So there would be sort of a dual advantage for wealthy people in this bill.
Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Listen to House Speaker Paul Ryan crowing now about his own health care plan and finally getting it considered on Capitol Hill. Despite his and the GOP's frustration with Obamacare, you can hear a real Ryan vision as well.
If you're going to repair the American healthcare system and fix its problems, you have to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better, patient-centered healthcare.
Ryan spoke on NBC's Meet the Press last weekend. Dr. Danielle Ofri says patient-centered healthcare is something that can be achieved without overhauling the entire healthcare system. As a doctor practicing medicine at Bellevue Hospital here in New York City and teaching in the NYU School of Medicine, she argues a simple innovation involves doctors just deciding to listen to their patients with their whole heart. If doctors could make the time, she says, put down the pen, step away from the computer, and just let a patient communicate uninterrupted for at least a full minute, it would accomplish a lot. What patients say, what doctors hear, is Dr. Ofri's profile of what she says is medicine's most important and powerful diagnostic tool, the doctor-patient conversation. Historically, Ofri says medical school students are taught little about this kind of tool, but things have got to start changing.
Increasingly, it's being recognized, but it's still a small part behind the, quote, hard sciences. But I think as we look at the data about error rates, misdiagnoses, if we're looking at if patient satisfaction now is counting in terms of hospital reimbursement, if we're looking at malpractice suits and the cost of that, I think we're beginning to realize that it's not an affable bonus, but a critical part to, you know, excellent patient care.
But are you saying that medical education prepares doctors really only to know extremely blunt statistics, blunt features of a patient's condition, like you would find in the emergency room, and anything more subtle than that is like almost impossible for them to see?
Right, because the subtle signs are very hard to teach. The way we teach in medicine, we use PowerPoint, we use multiple choice tests. But the way you teach communication skills and subtle skills is the, you know, small group one-on-one observation of a seasoned clinician interviewing a patient. It takes time, it takes resources, much harder to do. But I think as doctors move along in their careers, they recognize that these skills are the ones that really make them the great doctors and not just the fairly good doctors with good, you know, lists of things they've memorized.
That's interesting. When did you, in your own practice, in your own clinical work, discover that you needed to do work on the quality of the patient-doctor conversation?
Well, once or twice I've had medical errors where I didn't catch what was going on. And I realized in retrospect that buried in there was what was really important, but I missed it because it was, you know, mixed in. For example, there was a young woman who came in with a healthy woman with a minor scalp condition, and she also complained of various aches and pains in different parts of her body. I examined her. Nothing added up to any sort of illness. I just reassured her, you're healthy, you're fine. And I showed her out the door. And as she's out in the hallway, hand on the doorknob, she said, "Do you think maybe these parts hurt because that's where my boyfriend shot me with a dart gun?" And I had missed domestic violence. And she was giving me the somatic symptoms, the bodily symptoms, but she didn't feel comfortable talking about the abuse she had suffered. And I almost missed it. Had she not been courageous enough to hang on to the doorknob and tell me, I wouldn't have known. I would have just sent her along like many other doctors. And in fact, domestic violence and other issues, eating disorders and depression, suicidality, are there much more commonly than we are treating. And so we should be seeing this all the time, and yet patients aren't comfortable, and we don't ask. We stick with the concrete, manifest content in the words, and we can often miss it. And I realize that I need to really be careful when people are giving, for example, mixed symptoms like that, to be probing, is there anything else going on underneath before I write it off as just the aches and pains of life?
How do you get patients to trust you enough to maybe make that point at the beginning of the conversation rather than when they're on their way out the door?
So the listening in the beginning, even for a minute, is quite a lot. And I think a person will pick up on that you're respecting them, what they're saying is of value, makes a huge difference. The other place I find where trust can be gained is during the physical exam. Because the physical exam is the one point where we're together without technology between us. No computer, no scribe, no laptop. It's just the doctor and the patient touching, talking, and it's a kind of intimacy, a non-romantic one, but an intimacy, and often patients will reveal what's on their mind during the physical exam. So while I'm doing the physical exam to hear their heart and lungs, I'm also using it as a secondary time to have a slightly deeper conversation. Often that's the moment patients will talk about the more uncomfortable or embarrassing things.
There's also, I think, a responsibility on the part of patients to not feel as though an MRI means something real is being done for them, or a procedure is a sign that something actually meaningful is happening, and to get into some sort of relationship where the doctor and the patient can really sort of both see the subtleties of what's going on in someone's healthy life and therefore know very quickly when something's going wrong.
Well, that's why I feel that the patient as well needs to recognize that the doctor-patient conversation is the most important thing for them as well. We talk about the annual physical. It really is the annual history. It's the annual conversation that's much more important than the physical part or the blood test. And not to feel shortchanged if you didn't get, you know, 1,000 blood tests or an MRI or an antibiotic prescription, that the talking, the conversation is the medical diagnosis and can often be the medical treatment as well.
So, you know, how does this work at Bellevue and how does this work with students?
Well, so when we work with students, we encourage them to take a very full history, spend an hour if you'd like, and really talk to the patient. Forget writing things down. You're not responsible ultimately, so you can just take the time and talk. And honestly, the patients love the interviews by the students. They often think that's their real doctor because that's the person who spends the most time with them. And the student can often be the one who finds out the key to the diagnosis because it's only in the 45-minute conversation the patient will tell them the stray fact that could be the key to diagnosis. So protecting time for that, emphasizing that the talking part is the most important part, I think, is how we're going to train the next generation of doctors.
Is this going to be incremental, or is there a coming revolution in medical education? And will the reimbursement models follow those
Everything
kinds
is
of changes?
Incremental. The medical establishment is, you know, it's an aircraft carrier. We can't turn it around so easily. But we're starting to see it shift a little bit. For years, nobody wanted to go into primary care, internal medicine, pediatrics, because they're low paid, a lot of work. You wanted to go into the specialties that were higher paid, easier hours. That's beginning to shift. I see it amongst the students and house staff that they are finding the appeal of primary care. And partly, as medicine's become less lucrative, the people who used to go into medicine for money, they've departed. They're down in Wall Street or wherever. And those who come into medicine now really are there because they want to do it. And for many of them, it is being part of a patient's life. It's practicing in your community, in an underserved area where you can really make an enormous difference.
Dr. Danielle Ofri is an associate professor of medicine at the NYU School of Medicine. She practices medicine at Bellevue Hospital in New York and author of What Patients Say, What Doctors Hear. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
So what has your experience been communicating with your doctor?
Hi, this is Amanda from Waltham, Massachusetts. So my prior doctor used to diagnose me as obese. Oh, you have an ear infection? Well, maybe you should lose weight. Oh, you have XYZ? Well, maybe you should lose some weight. I really wish I was joking. This mindset is not just harmful, it's dangerous, and I know I'm not alone.
From Oakland, California, we go to our nurse practitioner first for medical concerns and physicals. She makes recommendations and referrals, often acting as a case manager. It took us a while to find someone like her, and it was worth the search. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. The address, 30 East Livingston Street, Tryon, North Carolina, is a long way from the sound that came from that until now little-known birthplace.
My skin is black. My arms are long.
Eunice Kathleen Wayman was a strong, happy girl growing up in the community of Tryon on the edge of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
My hair is woolly. My back is strong.
Her community recognized her talent early on, and they paid for her to take piano lessons and to go to a private high school. But it can be argued that the advantages she got in her career made her a fighter for justice in the Deep South later in her music, when she became the legendary Nina Simone, a voice straight out of history, art, and the civil rights movement.
Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow.
Nina Simone's home returned to the market in December of 2016, partially restored and seeking new ownership for a list price of $95,000. That's when New York artist Adam Pendleton, artist Rashid Johnson, Ellen Gallagher, and Julie Moretu purchased the house still haunted by the spirit of Simone, her many siblings, and proud parents. Pendleton says the purchase is part of a process of recovery and reclamation of America's racial history.
I think for us there was a kind of symbolic value to four artists stepping forward and saying, we're going to support and preserve the legacy of an artist like Nina Simone.
When you say Nina Simone is an artist, how does that distinguish her from a protest singer or a pop singer or, you know, someone else who she came up with at a very controversial time in entertainment in the United States?
Well, I think that's exactly what is interesting about Nina Simone is she's all those things. She's a soul singer, a jazz singer, an R&B singer. She's a civil rights icon. And I think it's the confluence of those things that makes her a particularly powerful example of all the things an artist can be in the world.
How does the house itself reflect anything you knew about Nina Simone before you visited it?
You know, I went to see the house in mid-February, actually, with the writer Randy Kennedy from the New York Times, and I kept saying to Randy, you know, this is a real adventure, because I had not seen the home before. But at that point, there was no turning back. We had purchased the house by the time.
Sight unseen. No kidding.
Yes. I think, you know, we had really only seen pictures of the home on the internet and gathered information from the broker, Cindy. But outside of that, we had not physically seen the home. And so seeing it for the first time, flying down to Charlotte and then driving about 90 minutes to Tryon was, you know, exciting to say the least. And when you pull up to the home, it's on a hill, and it really does look like something from the past. And if you stand on the porch, you can see the mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains are in your view. And it felt like the real deal, that it was significant.
What's your first step? Where do you start?
I think the first step is to, for me at least, and I think for all four of us involved, is to really establish a list of questions. What is a monument? How do you reanimate the past? What is the significance of Nina Simone today? How can this home figure into the local and national consciousness? And I think there are many questions beyond that. And I think we'll try to come up with creative solutions and answers to those questions that reactivate the site so that it doesn't become a dead place, a dead site, simply a dead monument, but it becomes something where people can actively reflect on the period that Nina Simone is primarily known for and figures importantly into American history.
And she provided her own oral history with so much spoken word.
Yes, indeed.
And music and all the concert performances. Yes. And everything that's out there. So you've got that going for you. And then I suspect looking through the windows and seeing the Blue Ridge Mountains must have been something that she, as a little girl, was inspired by and took with her out of that community.
Yes, one can only imagine. So this home was actually the second home the Waymans had in Tryon. And Tryon figured importantly in Nina's life. It's where she began to play piano. There was community support for her to study piano. When she went to high school, she went to Asheville, North Carolina, which is about, I would say, 40, 50 minutes from Tryon. So North Carolina really did shape her in many ways. In 1950, she left and studied at the Juilliard School of Music in New York. And that fascinates me. What was it like going from a small town like Tryon and moving to Harlem in 1950?
How is this similar to your art work, the kinds of work that you do that your own fans see?
You know, I, as an artist, am always turning towards past moments, figures, and trying to put them in relationship to things that they might not always be considered to have anything to do with. For example, I'll look at someone like W.E.B. Du Bois and Jean-Luc Godard at the same moment. Mm. Or I'll consider someone like Gertrude Stein and Stokely Carmichael. And I'm interested in what these sort of radical juxtapositions, what they create, what kind of dynamic they give life to. And I think that's something that I'll do with Nina Simone as well. I think it will be interesting to make unlikely pairings or look at things that aren't considered in relationship to her, like, say, conceptual art, mm-hmm. which also came about during the Civil Rights Movement as well. So I think there are many unlikely things that can be, you know, sort of brought to bear on this situation.
And to really restore Nina Simone beyond simply an archive of music, but as a living artistic figure.
Absolutely.
In real work.
Yes, you know, I think there's kind of a resurgence of interest in Nina Simone generally. It was only last year in 2016 that she won a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. And I think her music, particularly what one could term her protest anthems, from To Be Young, Gifted, and Black to Old Jim Crow to Four Women, they resonate as a, I think as a country we grapple with, you know, what are civil rights today? What civil rights are on the line today, you know?
Well, Adam Pendleton, good luck. And it's a great project. And we share a love of Nina Simone, that's for sure. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
New York-based artist Adam Pendleton is one of the four who purchased Nina Simone's home in Tryon, North Carolina.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain. Breaking rocks and serving my time.
Going home with Nina Simone. There's got to be a song in there somewhere. By the way, we want you to rat out your good and bad doctor conversations, so call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.